Maybe before we do anything, this is our first meeting as a particular committee after we've lost our committee and moving to see the standard. May his soul rest in peace. If you never lost your name, this long in the first period and even the memorial of service in Parliament was done, I think he was such a one. So, yeah, we've lost one of our own. But let me introduce this ticket. Yeah, ticket and stand up so that the members can see. This ticket has a place to stand in Israel. She's our new committee. So we got my sister in home. Again, it's a meeting where we'll be missing our member, who Honorable Ollis, but fortunately, with the Honorable Ollis, we got a chance to say our farewell speeches, our goodbye. But we'll definitely miss him. We'll definitely miss him. Maybe before I even start with the introduction of what was taking place today, Mr. Brown, there is a register.
I've received apologies from Honorable Guni, Honorable Koto, and Honorable there was also a letter from the Minister Chairperson for his apology. Those were the only apologies I've received today.
Thank you very much for that. Then we're greeted during your astrology. Yeah, today we are taking the presentation for the two topics, that is the update from the ministerial task team on the introduction of Israel from other subjects, and also we're getting the report, the full of the report on the rural education policy. These are very important topics. Talking directly to the issues of transformation in our system. We are eager, DM, to hear how far is the ministerial task team on the first topic. What recommendations have they come up with to you as ministry? Where to from here? When can you see the changes, if ever there are changes that are being proposed within those recommendations that are coming? Which we know the discussions that are there when it comes to history, but for you to know where you're going, to know where you are, your identity as such, you must be clear of your history, what is happening, for you to develop that pride of who you are and your country. The history is very important. In today, there is a very important role. And reading it, all the critics and the contributions, even from the newspaper, the media, as if once you ignore your history, you know, you are creating a community that won't be proud of who they are and from where they're coming from. So really, we've had a number of discussions when it comes to the question of history, but let us sit and listen then, Deputy Minister, is to say, what are those recommendations? And as a department right now, where are you taking the discussion for, and when can you see any recommendations as from now moving on? And also the issue of rural development is one area, even as a community, where you are very interested in. We are saying we need to bridge the gap to balance the kind of education that you get in the cities and towns, and that is the rural communities. That does not help when it comes to quality, where our rural areas could be found wanting. So it was a good thing that the department created that unit just to look solely on what is going to take place when it comes to rural development. There are so many questions then when we come to that topic in the Deputy Minister. There are so many things that we can think of, from the quality of teachers, infrastructure, you know, incentives for that. We'll get into that when we get into the topic, but now we'll start with history as a compulsory subject. And I can assure you that it has drawn a lot of attention even from the media itself. They have been calling, they want to hear exactly what is it that the department is coming up with, what are the recommendations that the team that the minister has set up has come up with. We know it has been launched, it has been given to the minister, so that is why we are here today. Share with us that document, share with us those recommendations so that we can all be on par and know exactly. And even to give us a window as to say, even I close with the input, if ever there are contributions, even from the honourable members themselves, yes, definitely, you'll get them today, but even moving on, what is it, yeah. How far are you with the process? Can I then hand over to you, DM, to lead us with the discussion?
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and it's good to be with the Portfolio Committee after a long while. My colleagues are saying we missed us, we haven't met for such a long time. I do actually miss the robust and vital discussions that take place in the Portfolio Committee. The Chairperson, we have Dr. Maboya, who's going to do a full presentation. Perhaps just to touch on a few areas. One is that there has been a huge appeal for us to take serious consideration of making history a compulsory subject. We know currently the state schools that history is offered until grade 9, and it's in the FET band that grade 10, 11, and 12 where we should take consideration to it. There was also consideration given to the sort of advice also as to whether indeed we should have it as a separate independent subject, in other words, increasing the number of subjects from 7 to 8 in matric in particular, or whether it should be integrated with life orientation. And that could be implications be in terms of teaching and learning time. We were also asked to look and reflect into the capacity of educators, in other words, are teachers competent enough to teach the subject adequately. But I think at the heart of it is what your opening remarks spoke to, is issues of identity and social cohesion. In other words, to understand our past, we are better able to understand the present and work in a very positive way for the future, and that is in practice in the National Development Plan, and indeed we endorse that. We're also a constitutional democracy that is committed to the creation of a non-racial, non-sexist, united and democratic society, and indeed our coat of arms is one in terms of which we celebrate our unity through our diversity. So the approach that we seek, and in fact the value that we seek from history being taught, would be one in terms of which we could create a platform for better understanding our past and the difficulties of the past, celebrating the achievements of the present, and certainly working hard towards a future. We do not want to pretend that there aren't difficulties and challenges in terms of the polarization of our society, the inequality, inequity that we are confronted with. The issue then is basically having due regard to our past, what do we do differently and in a better way, collectively, to create a better future? So the issues of that, our history, in other words, our present, our future should be anchored in our history, and if we're able to understand it and not afraid to confront it, then we certainly would create better citizens who would have a better civic duty. What the minister has done in 2015, convening a serial task team, very competent people who led the team, did a very, very thorough job in terms of looking at models, not only in Africa, but also in Asia, looked at it in France, in the Netherlands, and other European countries, and also in South America. So that we have a good view of whether history is indeed taught. And by and large, history is a compulsory subject in all countries. By and large, it's taught certainly up to grade 9, and in certain instances, it's a compulsory subject beyond grade 9, that is in grade 10 level itself in the FET band. The manner, you know, Rwanda and Zimbabwe, for example, teach history right up to grade 12. And given the Rwandan experience, for example, one could understand how important it is to confront the issues of ethnicity and the risk of ethnic division in the context of their past. Zimbabwe basically spoke about national identity and in fact fosters that in terms of teaching the subject. Our ability to create national a national South African identity and an ethnic identity. And that brings me to the other point here, Bertrand, and I'm going to be very brief because you're going to have a very comprehensive presentation from Dr. Maboya, and I don't want to think that I'm stealing all the points. But the issue of decolonization has been in the public domain and in this book. And we have to confront it. And quite honestly, what we've done as a department, and I have the privilege of co-chairing with Iron Venture in terms of the education dialogue, we've raised this discussion. And whereas people thought, well, it was with so much attention, and there was a very, very healthy, robust, vibrant discussion around the issue of decolonization, because it's a reality that we have to confront. So our history is also attached to our decolonization. And the question that was asked in terms of the terms of reference is it too Eurocentric? Should it be Afrocentric? And we didn't say it must be in a particular way. It was an open question. And what do we do? What is the role? What other elements do we take into account? And the very strong recommendation about archaeology, because that provides a scientific basis of our task. So for example, before, we think of Timbuktu as a place that nobody could find, but Timbuktu was perhaps the most precious resource, university resource of Africa, where reading and writing took place, where knowledge was disseminated, and where scholars from everywhere converged. Now, if we didn't understand that, and if we didn't understand our past and our history, we would think that all our knowledge is derived from Europe. What is the influence of Africa in terms of indigenous African knowledge in terms of development? So anthropology is one element that has to be looked at. We've also asked the team to look at the manner in which history is being taught, the context, the curriculum context, and to align the history content with the current National Curriculum Assessment Policy Statement. Is it too partial? Is it too biased? Is it inadequate? And so forth. And various recommendations have been made, both in terms of the GET band as well as the FET band. Now, I'm not going to go into the detail, but to say to you, what we receive at the end of the day, Chairperson, is a number of options that was presented to the minister. Say, look, option A, make it an additional subject, option B, integrate it with life orientation, and there were more than four options, in fact, more than three options, there were four options that were put to us. And the implications of teaching time were also set out, and there was sufficient reflection on the adequacy or lack thereof of educators in terms of the professional skills and development. Where we are now, certainly we've made the report public, we want to, this is one reason why we are engaging with this portfolio committee, because we want this portfolio committee as a collective to also influence and shape our decision in one way, to say, what are your thoughts? Please let us have it. And we are embarking on a process of consultation with stakeholders so that we don't really arbitrarily place in the curriculum without having had sufficient or adequate consultation. So this is where we are in the consultation phase. And Chair, as I've indicated, Dr. Maboya has been quite central to this whole very, very important task, and may I invite her with your permission to do the presentation. Thank you.
Members of the portfolio committee, good morning to you all. I will be presenting the whole sort of a summary of the recommendations that you got from the history ministerial council. But as we do that, the purpose is to present the recommendations of us on history as a comparable subject to the portfolio committee for discussion and further guidance. I think the GM has already alluded to the fact that we are presenting this so that the portfolio committee can have the opportunity to engage with the recommendations and also to give us their input. Now, we are also reminding members about the mandate that we derive from the National Development Plan, which sees history, heritage, and culture as important for understanding the past, the present, as well as for assisting us in terms of planning for the future. So this is mainly about the importance of history as a subject, but also the importance of history in as far as advancing social understanding and cohesion, which is important for social and economic stability and growth. But we also thought that we should include the problem statement because it actually highlights what prompted us to go the route of even appointing a task team to look into the possibility of offering the subject as a compulsory subject. This was mainly informed by the fact that the uptake of history was beginning to decline. And as we have alluded in our slide, the number of schools that offered history declined from 6,023 in 2018 to 5,404 in 2015. So we were studying the trend with regard to participation of learners in the subject itself. And that has become a worrying factor because then that would mean that whatever values that we could derive from the teaching of the subject, we're not going to promote that. And then there was also the continued decline of the subject meant that young people were more disconnected of their country and the society in which they live. I think this refers to the whole issue of the identity crisis that we normally talk about. If you don't know where you're coming from, it's very difficult for you to even know where you want to be. We also realize that if we don't really come in to rescue the situation, the youth will lose a sense of nationalism, patriotism, and national unity derived through the study of history. So all the good that we derive from the teaching of history would be lost if we don't intervene. The next one. As a background member, we just wanted to highlight the fact that there was a ministerial task team that was appointed in 2015. The purpose was to advise the minister on the possibility of offering this as a compulsory subject from grade 10 to grade 12. As you would know, history is compulsory, of course, up to grade 9. So when you get to grade 10 to 12, then history becomes one of the electives. So you choose to do it or not to do it. And we still have a roundtable discussion on this was held in December 2015 to further deliberate on the challenges that we were facing with regard to the teaching of history, where this ministerial task team was introduced. The team started the work in March 2016 and completed in December 2017. So the work of the ministerial task team was finalized in December 2017. However, the report was officially handed to the minister this year on the 31st of May. So the minister did receive the report, and the report was then also made public by putting it also on our website. And that is what attracted a lot of attention and interest on the matter. And these are the terms of reference that guided the work of the task team. In the first place, the task team was tasked to conduct a comparative study, international study, on how best to implement the introduction of compulsory history in our schools. Then they were also tasked to review and strengthen the content of history in both the FET and the GET. Because these are issues that also emerged from the roundtable to say that it's not only about making history compulsory, it's also about reviewing even the content of the history that we are offering. Then the other element of the terms of reference was to look at the capacity and capability of our teachers, where it became apparent that if USA makes this to compulsory, then that would mean that we have to look at whether we do have the capacity to do that. So then they will also have to audit the number of teachers who are of our ministry, number of trainee teachers who are of our ministry, but also propose teacher development programs in the area of both initial teacher preparation as well as continuous teacher development. Then the terms of reference also covers the issue of consultation, because obviously if you come up with such a significant change, then consultations become very important so that you can hear the views of the community, the views of professionals, the views of researchers and so on, so that ultimately we can make an informed decision. So consultations had to be organized by the task team themselves, and also to draft the implementation and management plan with AFM, including alignment of the history textbook with recommendation on key concepts and so on. So their work extended up to the level of making whatever proposals that they come up with to make them ready for gazetting of the policy and regulation amendments emanating from the process. The ministerial session was also to compile the final report, which is what was handed to the minister on the 31st of May 2018. Now, the most interesting part probably would be around the comparative study that was conducted. So the study looked at education systems in different countries. We looked at Africa as a continent, Latin America, Europe, as well as Asia. And those are the countries that a desktop exercise was undertaken to see how history is being offered in those systems. Now, these are the questions that occupied the task team when they did the whole exercise of doing the comparative study. They looked at whether history is compulsory in those systems, and if so, up to which grade. They will look at whether history is a standalone or integrated with other subjects and at which level. The second, the third one, which is related to the first, is to look at whether history, of course, composition of content framework is one of the areas that they look at, level of control or autonomy, what skills have been developed, reasons for the country's choice of a particular approach, and what kind of identity is being promoted in the country. Those were the questions that many candidates were asking and related to. And what we learned from that exercise, from the comparative study, what we learned from the comparative study is that history has quite an important place in the tried also to cite examples of such countries. In your Brazilian system, for instance, because of the fact that 53% of the population are Afro-Brazilian, it is mandatory that African history be taught. In Rwanda, for instance, history is offered or is influenced largely along your ethnic lines. For instance, we found that in Rwanda, the Tutsi perspective in the history of Rwanda is the most dominant. The teaching and implementation of patriotic history in Zimbabwe is one of the things that we highlight in our presentation, to say that we have a situation where patriotic history is offered in history, which is more aligned to the ruling party, and which is also the dominant political type of form. Now we also, as a summary, after doing the analysis, comparing the countries, and learning and unlearning some of the practices, then the task team then looked at Ghana as a possible model that our system could learn from. And so I spent time to summarize the Ghanaian model to say, in the Ghanaian model, in the history content, for instance, the school, Africa is put at the center. Not that they are not doing other histories, but they put Africa at the center, then before they go out to the world history. We have seen also in their model the centrality of ancient African history, that is your pre-colonial history. And in which case it is being offered at higher grades, and by that time at higher grades, at least the learners are cognitively well matured to can be able to make sense of colonial history and its complexities. Recognition that our history of Africa dates back to over a million years. This is what we found in the curriculum and the Rwanda or the Ghana system. Awareness that various ancient civilizations of Africa contributed to the pre-colonial era. I think what we are highlighting here is just that, unlike our content, which only probably starts from 1652, with the Ghanaian one, there is clear indication that we have what you call your pre-colonial history, which should also be emphasized in our curriculum. And also, their curriculum is also characterized by the importance of archaeology and the methodological tools it offers to deal with ancient African history. So that whatever they talk about in terms of pre-colonial history should be scientifically informed. And one of the things that they were doing is to conduct these consultative workshops. What we are highlighting here are the workshops that took place. For instance, we covered all the 9 provinces on those different ways. And the feedback that we got from these workshops is also summarized here to say that out of the consultation workshops that were conducted, this is what we are, the feedback that we are getting. The one feedback is around the need to separate history from geography from grade 4 up to grade 9. Because currently we are offering it as a combined subject, that is social sciences. The second one is about archaeology as being key to the teaching of history, and that it needs to be integrated into the curriculum because of the scientific nature of that discipline. History and geography teachers are not skilled enough. There was a recognition, of course, that teachers are not skilled to teach both subjects. So obviously, if you are good or at history, it means you will teach history to the detriment of geography and vice versa. The history content in the curriculum is very Eurocentric, unlike in the case of Ghana, where we said they put Africa at the center, whereas our curriculum has been designed in such a way that we put Europe and the West at the center, at the expense of both South Africa and the continent. History must not be integrated with life orientation, because there was also, you know, those discussions to say, if we've got so many subjects that are compulsory, when you add history, it means now you're going to increase the notional size. So there was another view that they can't combine the two and have a hybrid subject that is made up of both history and life orientation. But the feedback we got from these workshops was that history must not be integrated with life orientation, with the, of course, the acknowledgement that history has got its own importance and life orientation also has got its own importance. History should be compulsory in the FET band, but we must avoid the Rwanda, Zimbabwe approach, which promotes ethnicity and patriotic history. So that's the feedback that we got, having studied those systems that we referred to earlier on. And then there's a need for a paradigm shift away from Eurocentric history. I think I already addressed that one. Now the big question that they had to respond to as a task team was whether history should be compulsory in the FET band. And we just here highlighting the status of this subject in terms of the curriculum so that members can at least discuss from an informed position. In the curriculum currently in the intermediate phase, social sciences, which is the integration of both history and geography, is allocated 3 hours, right? And the life skills, we are talking about life skills because it's related to life orientation. So in terms of life skills, we have 4 hours that is allocated to life skills, of which 1.5 hours is allocated to creative arts. Physical education takes up 1 hour, and then the remaining 1.5 hours is allocated to personal and social well-being. Whereas when it comes to the senior phase, again, we still have social sciences instead of history and geography being separate subjects. And they are allocated 3 hours. And life orientation is allocated 2 hours, of which 1 hour is for physical education. So the other 1 hour is actually about life orientation and access. Like your human rights, like your right? And then when it gets to the FET band, life orientation, as we indicated, is one of the compulsory subjects that are allocated 2 hours. And just like in the senior phase, 1 hour is for physical education, and the other 1 hour is for the other aspects of life orientation. Mainly issues around you know, understanding and developing the self, issues around the writing and so on. And out of a list of electives, then we have history as one of the electives, which is accorded 4 hours per week. And altogether, when you look at the national time, can you go back? The notional time in the FET band altogether is 27.5 hours per week. Yeah, per week. Yeah, per week. 27.5 hours per week. Now, now I'm highlighting the issue of time because
in most cases, when you look at the scenarios that were presented to all, that were presented by the task team, they actually talk about the effect of time in terms of whatever scenario that we are looking at. Scenario A was where the history is made compulsory in grade 10 to 12, right? Meaning we take the curriculum as it is, but we elevate history and put it as one of the compulsory subjects. And what that would mean among other things that will increase the teaching time or the notional time from 27.5 per week to 31.5 per week. Learners will offer a minimum of 8 subjects instead of 7. Now we have added the higher subject which is compulsory. So meaning that we'll have 8 subjects all together. Flowing from all those things that we are actually offering currently. And scenario A continue, we look at the implications of scenario A for the sector, and we said that it would mean that we need to increase the number of fundamental subjects in the FEC band, increase from 4 to 5, because this now will be joining the league of those subjects that are compulsory and fundamental. That would also mean a 4-hour increase in the notional time. And of course, it will have budgetary implications, because that would mean that you need to get more teachers, you need to go and review the textbook, you need to go back and make sure that you provide LTSM for all the learners, while previously you were only providing textbooks for only 5,000 or 6,000 learners. So now it means you have to provide for almost 600, because that's almost the number of learners that are writing literature. Now scenario B is where we have a combination of history and life orientation, so that we have now a hybrid subject that is made up of both life orientation and history. Transfer history contents to LO to reinforce the teaching of citizenship, human rights, etc. A hybrid subject will be formed which may not be designated, but I think this one falls off because we no longer have designated such, all the subjects are designated. But the fact that we are combining a designated subject with a non-designated subject was also going to be effective. And the allocation of time for teaching history in the F could be compromised, because currently we have allocated 4 hours per week to the teaching of history, but when you combine them, it means 4 hours might not be sufficient. Then we're also looking at the implications to say the measure of the two may not be recognized by universities. And budgetary implications are almost the same, because once you combine them, it means that it's going to impact your LTSM, and so many things are going to be impacted. Then scenario C is where we're looking at history becoming a compulsory subject in grade 10 to 12, with the proviso that we remove LO as one of the fundamentals in the FEC bank. And that LO should remain compulsory until grade 9, and the content should be strengthened. Because what was raised about the content of history as a subject actually permeates the whole system. So say, not only in the FEC, even in the GED, we need to re-look into the content. So we need to strengthen the content of history, therefore, in the GET band. LO should be phased out of the FEC band incrementally, starting from 2023 up to 2025. The notional time in grade 10 should be increased from 27.5 hours per week to 29.2 hours per week, because if you retain the 4 hours for history and you remove the 2 hours for LO, so it means you are only increasing the notional time by 2 hours and not by 4 hours. Right? and it has also its own implications. One of the implications is that the compulsory subject will remain in four in total, and there will be a 2-hour increase in notional time, and the budgetary implications are almost the same as with other scenarios. And the last scenario that was painted is where we look at history becoming compulsory, right? With the proviso that we remove life orientation in both GEP and FET bands. Because people are arguing that LO is studied differently in different schools due to the inequalities in our different communities. And there's also this scenario also recognizes the fact that in your former model school and private school, there's meaningful work that is assigned to the subject, and that empowers learners with certain competencies and empowers them life-changing skills, whereas the less affluent schools cut corners due to lack of resources. So the implications, there will be a decrease in notional time, intermediate 2.5 hours, and senior phase 2 hours. So meaning that instead of 27.5 hours that we have as our notional time per week, then we'll go to probably 25 hours per week, as well as 24.5 hours a week in the case of the intermediate. 2-hour increase in notional time in the FET band, 95 progress and adjustments made in life orientation. These are the implications. Of course, there are also budgetary implications. Now, out of the four scenarios that we have just reflected on, then the ministerial task team then came up, because this was one of their terms of reference, to say, ultimately, come with us with a recommendation. So this is what they recommended to the minister. They recommended that it should be compulsory at FET band, and should replace life orientation as the fourth fundamental subject. That's number one. Number two, life orientation should remain compulsory up to grade 9, and the content thereof should be strengthened. The other one is that LO should be phased out of the FET band from 2023 to 2025, incrementally so until 2025. The DBE will have 5 to 6 years of preparing the system for the implementation of compulsory history. The notional time for grade 10 to 11 will have to increase from 27.5 to 29.5 per week. GET social sciences, the separation of history and geography has been recommended, and that history should be a standalone subject. Then we also have from the recommendations of the MSCC that realignment of teacher education and development to ensure that teachers are learning history, archaeology, historical anthropology, African literature, and all those aspects of history that in which we were found wanting. The curriculum has got this is what the recommendations continue to say to us from the MCC, that the curriculum, the CAP curriculum and serious communication, therefore, a complete overhaul of CAP is required. We have already mentioned the fact that our history does not necessarily include your pre-colonial history. It doesn't include the issue of archaeology as an approach, the teaching of history. It doesn't include, it does not put Africa at the center. So as a result, we need to completely overhaul the curriculum. Africa centeredness, I think we've already spoken to that, should be adopted as a principle as we revisit the content. Ancient history and pre-colonial African history should also be brought into the fold as we review the curriculum. Assessment should consist of two final papers. Paper one focusing on African history, including Africa, including South African history, and paper two should focus on the world history or vice versa. The reason for both recommendations is because currently learners are given a choice. When they write exam, they might choose to respond to questions that deal to the world history or the one that deals with South African or African history. So as a result, there is a risk here that the other histories might not be taught. So if you examine both separately, then you are forced to teach both. Then the further recommendation is that DBE should provide funding for prospective history teachers to include the Lusaka Bazaru scheme. I must also hasten to mention that this is one of the modalities that we want to use. It doesn't mean that this is the only way in which we are going to address the issue of teacher capacity and teacher capability in terms of making sure that we have the necessary human resource, human capital to can drive this mandate. Should we opt to really abide by this recommendation? We're also looking at things like looking at the existing crop of teachers that we have in teachers to say, can we upscale their skills? Or in some instances, can we reskill teachers so that they can become competent history teachers? DBE needs to know budgetary implications of compulsory history in the FCT related to capacity teacher training, content alignment, and textbook alignment. We've already alluded to that. Then what are the implications of this recommendation for the sector? For the sector, if these recommendations are anything to go by, then this would mean the number of fundamental subjects in FET will remain at 4 instead of being increased to 5. 2-hour increase in notional time, budgetary implications as we have already said. The next one. Now, what has happened since we received this recommendation? We have tried to process the recommendation. Should we go this way? Especially should we go in line with the recommendations of the ministerial task team? What are the things that we need to be asked? For instance, we looked at curriculum, one of the components. We looked at exams and assessments, LPSS, and research development, and try to say, what does it mean for us as a system if these things or the different components have to be impacted by the decision to make this thing compulsory? And I'm not necessarily going to go through this. Right. Next one. And what are the next steps in terms of taking the process forward? We need to reappoint the very same ministry. Ministerial task team. Maybe there could be some additions depending on the need to conclude the development of the revised history content, because for us that is quite key, more than just making it compulsory. We are also saying even if you make it compulsory, you still have to revise the content. Present and share the history report with different stakeholders, which is what we are currently doing. We have already started with the consultations, and this is one of the processes that we are undertaking. Establishment of an inter-brand team to evaluate the implications of the various scenarios above the ones that we have already alluded to, the four scenarios, what are the implications for the sector, and also to consult the basic education sector on the recommendations. This is the process plan for consultation. As I indicated, this is one of the processes in regard to the consultations that we are supposed to conduct. So those consultations have already taken place and others are still to take place. interested in me, as you can see, we also have a relation with the union principal as well as with the union. And we will also be forthcoming engaging with the structural process, the National Consulting Forum, with regards to SGB. And what we are recommending to the committee is that the portfolio committee should discuss the recommendations of the National Consulting Forum user and provide input. Thank you very much, Dr. Maria, for that presentation. I know it has provoked a lot of questions because we are present. You know, I could see we are all saying there's so much that you want to, the clarification questions that we have on your presentation, but we warmly welcome the presentation. Maybe let me reserve my comments for now. Let me only ask for members to engage with the presentation as it has been presented to us. The progress, of course, on where the department is and the ministerial testing recommendations that they are. Can I start with you, Honorable Macheke? Honorable Macheke, Honorable Baston, Honorable Mwenzi, Honorable Bosho, and that possibly.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the presentation. And it's good to see the Deputy Minister and Professor Lamkin. I just want to say, first of all, I think we appreciate the work that has been done by the ministerial task team that was tasked to give us clarity and the recommendation on this issue of history. We do basically agree with the fact that, you know, the curriculum at the moment, it really doesn't reflect South Africa as a country, and also doesn't give knowledge to the students about Africa as a continent. So that definitely needs to be reviewed, and you know, we need to make sure that the content reflects our history as South Africans. But then the report, basically, it doesn't substantiate why the issue of reading is compulsory after grade 12. There isn't much proof that, you know, it does make learners to be patriotic and, you know, to be more responsible. So there was a lack of that, and we basically believe that, you know, if it can be looked at the curriculum itself, but to allow history to stay in the days after grade 9, as long as the content is changed in such a way that, you know, it reflects those two issues. And also, we basically also, as well, you know, the issue that has been brought into the media to say, you know, it can be used for political indoctrination. I didn't believe that, because that was the case that had been done a long time ago with the current history and, you know, life orientation. So that is not something that we are concerned about. The only issue that we are concerned about is the time that is going to be rolled after the 5 years. So it seems that it's going to be enough, but not really for grade 12, but looking at the content itself. I'm not sure if that will be sufficient to be able to do that, because the last thing that you want to do is to have a syllabus and then again go back and review it again, you know. That, so I'm just looking at the time that you're taking about to ensure that it is ready to be rolled out. And also, you know, bringing the archaeology discipline that is a very good aspect that we can bring in. And also, you know, to offer it as a hybrid, I don't think it's going to be a good recommendation, because we need to have history as a subject after grade 9, and then those learners who want to choose history, they can choose it and be able to go into university to either study law or even to be historians. LO as well. We need to strengthen the LO because at the moment, as we say, that you know, schools in townships, they don't have, and also rural areas, they don't have enough resources to be able to really ensure that they get the benefit of LO. But also, maybe what we can talk about is maybe the scenario C, as you mentioned. Just on the LO, to say, you know, we strengthen it and maybe it goes up to GDT, which is grade 9. And then maybe introduce a subject like IT. I mean, that's the recommendation, IT or coding. That will allow learners to have exposure of IT, because we really need learners that can actually be able to modify words and, you know, also if you have IT from grade 10 to grade 12, that can actually not only allow you to go to university, but can also work out of the credit. So the university provides 6 months, one semester of IT. That would be an advantage for everyone. So based on the recommendation. And also, like, you know, the report, when you read it from the beginning, it says that the minister was very much under pressure to ensure that this is done and rolled out. I would just like to find out from the deputy minister why was the pressure and where was it coming from.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you for the report. We appreciate the work done by the Ministerial Task Team. Though, in my view, I think if our Chairperson from the Procurement Committee was also part of this, I appreciate the thought, the thinking behind the history being revised and more emphasis being put on African history, especially pre-colonial and post-colonial. Why I say this, I remember when I was doing my trip myself, we were doing a history book by Fowler and Bismarck. And the first chapter in that book, it was the course of the French Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
I studied and I wrote the test. And at the end of the test, after the result, I passed. But I asked myself, what am I going to do with the course of the French Revolution? I was 17 at the time. Then I said, okay, let me drop, because there are two subjects to choose between geography and history. So I went to geography class. I'm actually putting myself as a student now, thinking about these children today. Then I said, at least let me go and study geography so that when I travel the world, I will know exactly where I'm going. And I did that. So I dropped history. So I really agree on the emphasis of African history. Because what brought me was to be reading the concept of the French Revolution. But what I did when we were doing our studies in the afternoon, I would borrow their history book. Now that I know what I'm doing. So I used to read it as a novel when they are not reading it, and then I would take it. And then that is how you as a child get to understand what is going on in the world. And I read that Bismarck book, everything about Mussolini and that. So we must also, as we do this debate, take ourselves and put ourselves as if we are students, the child thinking. When we are going to do this change. Also, I'm a bit worried about making history compulsory, especially at SDC College. I'm thinking of a child who wants to be an electrician, who wants to be a plumber. What is he going to do with history at that level? I think that's good for him. Also, children who love mathematics and physics, they like to do formulas. And if you are not a person who likes to read, because if you are going to do history, you really have to read. So we need to promote a lot of reading. We will definitely compromise maybe their marks. Because I can assure you, a child who is good in mathematics and in physics just wants to do formulas, etc. And then a child who loves literature will definitely do well in history. So we need to look into the compulsory part, especially for grade 11 and grade 12. Maybe if it's introduced as an independent subject so that it does not, you see the progress of the children, so that it does not affect their marks at the end of the examination period. And what was the last thing now? No, thank you. That's the idea.
One other question.
Thank you, Chair Petson. Ms. Maguia, Deputy, thank you for the presentation. When the presentation, I mean, history as a subject and being compulsory is long overdue. Maybe in your presentation you say the schools that are offering history are declining. It's because of type of history that we're giving. We're giving them a dead history, history that doesn't speak to them, history that has no meaning to them. That is the children you see, as Honorable Majegele said, she dropped it because she's a woman of history to it. A nation without history is a lost nation without a people. So for me, the model, the Ghana model, the African history, it's still the best because it speaks to us as Africans. So, well done for the task team. Well done. As you have noticed that there are challenges. I was just doing when Chairperson said I must say something. I was just assimilating what Mrs. Honorable Majeka was saying. Maybe it will jeopardize the choice as mathematicians would like to take. I think it's broadening the scope of a chapter. For me, history will not reduce, as you have presented, will not reduce the scope of choice of a child. It will increase it and give the child a broader scope up to a FET level. Then when going to university, a child will be broader minded to have his or her own choice. Because math will be there, science will be there, history will be the eighth subject. On the subject, the fourth one for compulsory subject. So I see the work or the research done is very relevant, and so far is good. It's only that we must try to address the hiccups. What are the hiccups that noticed while you were presenting? When you said that at GET phase or LO will go maybe on the recommendations of the testing, LO will go up to GET phase, that is great. Then you say LO embraces the physical education, the creative art, the what the well-being, personal well-being of the child. My question was, and now there is this child who wants to proceed with creative art at university. How is he going or she going to be accredited to be able to take creative art at the university level, having not done it at FET level? Or is that dancer, that ballet, that child and what
wants to do his or her degree in terms of now not having the background of FET having that. So that was only my main concern. And also the notion time, I was just worried about 31.5 hours, but when you came to calculation of 29, although 29 is dropping the LO, when you say 29 is better. So on your, at the end, on your consultation timetable, I noticed that you are still going to consult the union. That's my problem. That I find that unions are very important because they are the implementers. They are our engines that should drive the work. If we still going and we are going so far, what if they rebel? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Honorable Chairperson, Honorable Chairperson, Honorable Attorney Boyer, and the two honorable members. We agree in principle that people must be compassionate, but also correct history must be written about Africa. Not just any history. I'll make an example of a chair. This day in the FAPTY, this Marikana massacre is always made there. And just after that, something also that they put in. Now. And I'm looking at these two things. I'm saying, if we are able to take history and use it to discuss the past, we are dividing the nation. Perhaps we should, you know, I know that there are things that have been done, you know, about the Marikana things and all that, but, you know, you'll never heal those families who got that. And those who got wounded. So when Honorable Machetso showed that she doesn't agree that history is used by the media for political, that is a very good example of what is happening. And I want also to remind you that the IFP took a certain matter with a certain writer who wrote a book with the Prince of Chile, with the pen written in the blood. I think you remember that.
Mm-hmm.
It was a history book, for sure. And I'm saying to you, if you read on the, I think it's the second page, the Honorable Chair and Dr. Norman Boyer, not the second page, but my page, which I think I'm not going to play, is page 3.
Mm-hmm.
Somewhere where it says history, heritage, and culture are important for understanding the past,
mm-hmm.
analyzing the present, and planning for the future. We may, I mean, understand what happened, but what we are more worried about is the present, because we want to plan for the future. And one of the biggest challenges that South Africa and Africa is facing is you know, there is very little social cohesion if there is any. In fact, we fear one another as Africans. We have not begun to, you know, to treat really one another. We treat one another with fear. If Deputy Minister is going to say something, I ask myself, hey, isn't he going to attack today? Attack the person. Hey, what was he going to say today? Because we still live in fears of the past. So I just wanted to put that to and then also that
You know, those who write history are those who have won the battle, because they've got all the resources to maneuver and write what they like. So I don't know why we'll be, you know, writing this book, because, you know, I think historians, they tell history like journalists. So I'm fearful of the writers who will write history for their literature to be sold well, to sell well in the market, because maybe we or some people in government are happy about that, you know. So I don't know how are we going to like control that, the honorable chairperson. And one last issue, Chair, while I'm still a teacher, I would discourage learners from doing mathematical literacy. You know why? It is because mathematical, if you can't understand English, you can't read, analyze, and write, you'll never pass mathematics. In fact, at school, I remember my teacher would say, no, this chapter is not important. Because she would not teach that, because I think she could not, you know, read, but that was mathematical. I think it was called functional math or something. So I was never taught functional math at school, because the teacher would tell me that, no, this chapter is not important. Up until I finished my degree, then I was forced to teach. Then I started saying, oh, this is the chapter that my teachers would always run away. So if we don't know, inculcate the culture of reading and writing on our learners, what Honorable Majeri is saying is going to happen, because look at how the children are writing. Even us as adults, just read what we write on WhatsApp. You see, sometimes it's incorrect wording, but we can understand it for the purpose of informal communication. So the kids are doing that. If you tell a child to write the word success or successful, you'll find it difficult to write that. You'll write something else, but maybe you can read that. So in the event where someone who knows that it is difficult for him or her to read and write, then that person will find it difficult. In fact, history will damage his or her results at grade 12. But only to find that all the other subjects are good, because that is where the learner is actually good at. I agree also, Chairperson, on scenario, presentation of scenario number 7.6C, we need to, or perhaps we must consider removing life orientation. I agree with that. It has always been my concern, and in fact our concern in ISP, that you know you waste a lot of time for these kids, but when these people arrive at the university, these marks that they got are not counted. You know, it can be taught until grade 9, because we need young people who are, you know, aware of the changes that happen first in their bodies or in the environment or for whatever, you know, life orientation was established for. And Chairperson, I see that there is a proposal from the ministerial task team that history teachers be funded by consumption. You know, Chair, I think we must one day analyze how we find and recruit these teachers. You see, I agree for good purpose that Fundan Shara funded students or graduates must be given preference. But they must undergo interviews, Chairperson. Even if they can compete among one another, I think in the oversight I don't know which oversight we will have. Somebody said, no, some people will prefer the old teachers because they have experience over the Funzan. They will not take Funzan Shadow. Mm-hmm. But why? It is because I sit here in the office and look at the database of schools which post. Then I say, Mr. Mwesi can sit here. I send him with the letter. There is even no time there to actually interview that student, if that student can actually teach them. Because that someone has a degree does not mean that person can actually perform. Perhaps that person needs a lot of development. You see. So we are creating inequalities, Chairperson. I know that this is not the main topic, but we are creating inequalities in our graduates. Because you go out and look at the students who are not working today, who have got education qualifications, are mostly self-funded and NSFAS recipients. Because the majority of schools and shadows are placed. But these ones are given the last preference, even to the foreign national, if they don't have experience. So I'm saying, why is there is this good proposal? But let's consider that today. Mm-hmm. We will continue to engage as we finalize the implementation. Of course, I said we support this, but we are more worried also for correcting chapters.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Honorable Marshall. But, Mr. Minister, I know you'll get a chance. I know Honorable Lewis is opening up something that we have discussed in this level of the control committee just today. We've got from the Lushara buzzer. We've got my child. My child might not have got from the Lushara buzzer. But also, he needs to get opportunity, you know. So we are only saying, yes, the government has invested in them, but also, with that Google child, he will not get stolen. We need to create, if not for the time, I'm happy he raised it. Maybe you will help him use when it comes to that. Knowing very much that. Yeah, we will find the first day, but we need to talk about it. Honorable Bishop.
Thank you very much, Chair. And I'm not going to go through the whole thing of congratulations on the proposal. My colleague next to me has touched on the DMHC with regard to history. I just feel that if it were to become compulsory up until the trick, it is going to curtail the learner's choices. Because not everybody that wants to become an engineer needs history. So one has to look very carefully at those type of things. These students must be given some form of latitude in an area of specialization. We touched on everything, but I'd like to know what were the audited outcomes of teachers available and those that we still need for the subject, from grade 4 right up to grade 12 then, and what is the cost? And by when, because the report speaks 2030, the NDP speaks to 2030, when do you propose implementing the subject? And then I'd just like to know the interest of history. Have you done a study amongst teachers currently, what their interest is? And then I'd also like to know, with regard to the Funza Lushaka bursary, you're going to make that available for prospective learners who would like to do history. What happens if you get nobody that's interested? Are you going to make it you can only be given the bursary if you take history as a subject to be able to teach it. Then I'd just like to know, Honorable Basson spoke about the teacher unions. What would the discussion entail? If you could give us a brief background, because looking at the notional time, it's going to increase, and I can see that we're going to be opposed on that by teacher unions. I didn't pick up anything about subject advisors. What percentage of subject advisors do we have in the history field? And then lastly, Chair, You speak of strengthening life orientation. What does this entail? Because we need to know in the DET vein what LO would be standing for at the end of the day. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and thanks Dr. Mavoid and the Deputy Minister for the presentation. Chairperson, many of the things have been said by my colleagues, but I really would like to welcome the proposal of history unit compulsory subjects, because it really helps our children to better understand of the past moving to the future. What is important, Chairperson, is that as there are few challenges raised by colleagues, is that history books need to be fairly scrutinized to ensure that they don't distort the information that our children will require. The only issue I wanted to raise maybe with the department is to check on maybe the readiness of the department with regard to the provision of quality educators, the LTSM. With educators, I'm raising this question because currently there is a problem wherein the history teachers are being reduced to a very minimal number, wherein many of them are no longer offering that subject. We have a challenge in that regard. To an extent that come the implementation time, we are going to have a serious challenge. I'm also looking at the 3 to 5 years as to whether it's sufficient for the DBE to prepare for the implementation. One other thing is to check it to what type of mobilization is there to ensure that student teachers in university are made to develop interest, looking at the current situation where in history teachers are being redeployed to work in primary schools because of the decline that we are having. So it is very important to ensure that we look also at the 5 years vis-a-vis those years where in been affected by when history was declined as a subject, to ensure that will are these years equal to the years that we are trying to start with the implementation of the history as a subject. Thank you very much. But lastly, I must indicate that it received my overwhelming support, and to further aid the department to fast track all the avenues leading to the implementation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to talk about the emotional time that you mentioned that. I think we believe that the emotional time should be less than 27.5, because we believe that our teachers are already under enormous pressure, as much as our learners. So hence we are saying that, you know, we could prefer history to be offered compulsory after grade 9. So that, you know, there's no change really on the emotional time. Thank you, Chair. Thank you very much.
I think all of the honourable members, we all agree on the issue of social cohesion, the importance of history, how important it is for us to make sure that we create the learners who have that pride about their country, where you say that sense of nationalism. I think basically that is what we
agree upon patriotism, that is what you are referring to, the national unity and so forth, of which I think we all believe that history can play that very important part. For me, again, that will go to an argument that says, what if Elena does not need that to do whatever career that is going to be taking after matric? But what I can argue is to say, when we believe in these principles, of which you say we are introducing, we wish to see history being compulsory, every learner to be taking history. For me, it says no matter if you choose to be a doctor, but if you have that background, that pride of who you are, national, you know, it will assist you. You are an engineer, you are whoever. For me, it will say, I'll join those who are saying we really would be taking our country to another level if we need to take a balance so that each and every learner understands very well where we are coming from and where we're going to. But getting to the question of how and when are we going to get the correct content that you want to see our learners to be exposed to. I'm just reminded of Honorable Majede when he talked of who's this writer, this book, Bismarck. You know, the end of which that history was taught, that we were all exposed to, that, of which we ended up not even interested in history because the content did not mean a thing to us. So the importance of the content, then again, it will go back to the time that is. We have to prepare all those. For me, one fundamental thing is the argument and the understanding that UDBE would be having higher education and training. For them to change the program, the content, because even now, history teachers are being produced, but they are produced in the history that you want to do away with. So how ready also is your counterpart, the Department of Education, with the content that we believe, in brackets for my word, I would say the correct content that we are expecting our teachers to teach. And so the inclusion and your arguments with the higher education, I think, is very important. Maybe you need to talk to others to say how that can interest. But that should go back to the 5 years, I guess, that you are saying, how can we speed up all these processes? Even engaging the publishers, we need those that correct content. It's very important. The upskilling of teachers, because yes, we can do the audit, we need to do the audit of the history teachers, but there's so much work if we're going to introduce all those aspects that you're talking about. That will end up in another way, we don't have the necessary skilled history teachers in the system right now. How are we reskilling and upskilling them? That program, is it going to be suitable to fit in the 5 years that we have? So I think there's still a lot that we need to do when it comes to the introduction of this history. But really, I think the idea is good. We need to see our learners. And when it comes to the unions, let us not be late to involve them. Please bring them on board, because definitely when it comes to the issue of notional time, it is going to be affected in one way or the other. Again, for me, when you talk to the introduction of his as a compulsory subject, the FET band, DM, it's necessitated the whole change of history starting from the lower grade. So it's a huge task that is ahead of you in the department. Because we can't just introduce with all those aspects having not done the groundwork from the GT base. So we really need a lot of time. I'm not saying 5 years is not enough, but I will prepare because it will be, you know, a marathon of things and programs that are still going to take place. How are we going to, your plans should be mindful of that. So there's still a lot of really what you need to do when it comes to that. I'm also happy again on the top of the cordon, where it's going to happen. That you are going to cover. I think for quite a long time, really, our history was the week we started. It started in 1652, of which is not the case. What happened before that? Where were we? Didn't we have a country? The Cape Town was not there, nothing, you know. So those are the things that you still need to dig in and say, let us have a clear picture and a proper history so that we are proud of who we are. Let us open up that time that was not exposed to us. Let the nation now be exposed to that. But let me just summarize this to say, we are looking forward to see how you unpack, how you unfold moving forward. We are not saying we are history because of the Jews, as the FET stands right now, but we are one of those who are saying, if it can be compulsory, we wish to see it compulsory for that identity, for that national thing, for that pride of our nation. So we wish you all the best. We know with that tactic that is going to be called again to make sure that they finalize with these processes. Let it be soon. Because again, when we look towards 2020, the time is not on your side. So we wish to see the minister appointing the minister of task team again to pass forward and fast track this to the task that you have already started. Can I hand over to you?
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and thank you to the esteemed members for their contribution. We've listened very attentively to each one of the contributions because the value merits and listening to other voices, and part of our task as the department is to ensure that there is a proper consultative process. The Honourable Chairperson spoke about anecdotally about the experience of as a teacher, as a learner and as a teacher. And I, if I were to speak anecdotally about it, I remember in 1963, I was grade 5, and the third sentence that we were taught in history was in 1652, as you correctly pointed out, young subjects landed from the Cape in the Kurawa, Dromedara, in the Reiko. I still remember, because that was drummed into our heads, and our history commenced with the arrival of the settlers. And that means the fact that you can remember it, and I can remember it, and it was in 1963, and we're quite far from 1963 right now, meant that it was embedded into our psyche that that is our history, and certainly it speaks to the need. The second one is really about reality. I did mathematics in school, I did accountancy in school, and I did history. I love my mathematics and the community, and I did very well, in fact, very well in history. But I did better because of my command of the language rather than the content that I had to pass over, because I certainly dissociated with a lot of it. And the textbook writer at that time was A.N. Boyce of history, and it was a very distorted version of South African history, unfortunately. That was the reality. So we've lived through that fiscal period, and the reality of colonialism cannot be wished away. The reality of apartheid cannot be wished away. The reality of the struggle of our people cannot be wished away. And I want us to reflect very, very carefully about the psychological, emotional, and cognitive growth of a child. So you teach history, we want authentic history. We don't want distorted history, and I certainly agree with Honorable McQuaid. Let's not have a partial history. Let's reflect history as it occurs, so that we don't use it for political purposes or ideological purposes, rather it is true and authentic record of the past. But cognitively, it is only in events, in grades 10, 11, and 12, where children can really grapple with the reality of the history. Whether it's history in relation to the land question, whether it's history in relation to racism, whether it's history in relation to non-sexism or in terms of our constitution itself. What happens in earlier years is rather a mechanical regurgitation of facts that are taught. It is at the level of cognitive development at that level, grades 10, 11, and 12, where history can become an exciting and real subject. And I thought it's important for us to recognize that, because otherwise it loses its value and meaning. You know, so I make that point in general, but let me rather, before I make my concluding remarks in relation to the various suggestions that have come, speak to the issues that have indeed been raised. And again, I say, so even if I have a different view, I take very, very seriously the proposals. The Honourable Mukherjee has basically spoken about the rationale, and I agree. There has to be a rationale as to why it should be made. And I would like us to link that with the last statement she made in the first presentation. Is there perhaps a view, or has there been some pressure on the Minister of Education? I belong to the same political party, the African National Congress, which is the ruling of the governing party and such. And the decision to make history compulsory subject wasn't taken a year ago. It's, I think it's the third conference, second, at least the second, but probably the third conference of the ANC, where we said that history must be made compulsory subject. But this very organization has at each one of its conferences affirmed three things. One is that we must fight against the demon of racism and tribalism. That's the commitment. So that's why we don't want a parochial view of history, but a cohesive view of history. Second, that we have to develop learners, and that comes from the freedom, inspired by the freedom charter, learners who basically are committed to equality, but who also are proud of their African identity and could and also recognize that they form part of the international community, the global community, and they are committed to justice and peace. So that notion of history and identity being South African, African, and global is a reality that we call it. And that is what that political party has mandated us to do. To say, when you look at history, don't look at it only as South African, look at it as South African, African, and global, because we have a particularly important responsibility in fostering peace and justice worldwide. Society. Those are the founding provisions of our constitution. And they cannot be a mandate unless you have a 75% job. But it's not a two-thirds, it's a 75% job. That is the strength of that constitutional framework that should guide us, should be the lodestar in the future. But given the reality of it, let me show you and demonstrate to you very, very clearly how an understanding of our history and an analysis of our history can create a transformation of society in a way that we can all celebrate. This year we celebrate Nelson Mandela and other people this year, both heroine and a hero of our strike. Even the DA is willing to adopt Nelson Mandela as its leader. So it's not contentious. So if we understand him better, whether you are DA, whether you are ISP, whether you are ANC, doesn't matter. He represents a particular caliber, a character, personality, whom we can all celebrate. The same can be said about Albertina Sisulu. I haven't heard an unkind word spoken about her by any political party, because the attributes that she carries with her are attributes that we want to view in our children. And by understanding their history, and their perspective, and their attitudes, and their values, I think we can indeed develop that ability. So that's important. But the commitment, the understanding of the history was this. The ANC, the ruling party, that reflected on the reality that women were underrepresented, were oppressed, were excluded. And what did it do? It took, on the basis of that understanding, decisive steps to change the policy. What did it do? It said that even when you have your public representatives, there must be at least 50% of your representatives who are women. So we go to our parliament, we celebrate representatives. But it's taken on the basis of a decision and an understanding of the history where women were excluded when they were oppressed, and we were subjected to certainly, you know, subjugated to all kinds of unequal treatment. We did the same in terms of our judiciary. Now, if we had to say, look, we understand the history, it will happen in due course. Nothing will be able to change. We have to recognize that in order to make the judiciary credible and representative, you had to have blacks and you had to have women, because they were underrepresented or not represented at all. It took a decision based on the analysis and understanding of history. Now that's an informed analysis that brings about revolutionary change that we celebrate. So today we say, wow, isn't it wonderful? We looked at in education, the old sector itself, we paid particular attention to the donors. And one of the benefits of it, they're producing more distinction than boilers, the retention rate is higher, the throughput rate in universities is higher. Was that the reality 25 years ago? No. So because we understood that history and we analyzed it, and develop an action plan informed by those realities, we're able to transform society. Now, if we're to argue now that our history is not important and our understanding of history is not important, we're betraying the values of Nelson Mandela and Albertina Sisulu. We're saying to them, your struggle and your views and your attitudes were of no consequence. We in a different society, we've got our freedom. Thank you very much. Goodbye to your attitudes. And attitude is that. See again, okay, at that point in time. So I make that point with regard to that. Now, with regard to the to history as neglected, yes, it can be neglected. And it's unfortunate. I think history is not being taught in exciting ways. If it is taught in exciting ways, you certainly would have more people learn taking up the subject. And teaching becomes quite critical. But my personal view, and because it's not a final view, it's going to be informed by the reality of consultation. My personal subjective view is, please do not sacrifice life orientation as the author of history. They're both equally important. I give you a real example, a very, very real example, and to make you understand what I'm saying. We've just come from the International Conference of HIV and AIDS and TB, and we've held it as today. The incidence of HIV and AIDS is the highest between 16 and 25 year olds. It means, and in fact the decision that was taken there, and all stakeholders said, that sexuality education becomes so critical and central to that. And where does that take place? Not in geography, not in history, not in accountancy, but in life orientation. We talk about sustainable development. It's so critical in so many years. Not just interstate people, but I'm saying at that particular age, that cohort, that's in the FET band, that's when children really become aware of their sexuality, where they are taught to make appropriate choices, where they are taught you cannot protect yourself from peer pressure. Now, if we take away that element then and say, put history as much as I love it, give history, let it replace type orientation, I think we're going to be winning. Already the department has reflected on the need to ensure that at least 50% of the assessment of life orientation must be examinable, must be tested. It is on the periphery because it's class-based assessment. And that's, if you look at the marks, they tell you a story on its own. Nobody fails life orientation. Nobody gets below 80%. Why? Because it's class-based. And universities don't take into account. When you tell universities, listen, you've got to take into account, we are going to accept it in the family, it's an examinable subject. Universities will make it. Now, the discourse in the corporate world, notwithstanding the incredible achievements of robotics and three-dimensional transmitter and technology, is that leadership within the corporate sector in the corporate world lacks one thing: the ability to socially interact with people, the ability to talk. The thing that the worst curse of ICT is that it takes away the element of socialization and socialization. And if we don't guard against that, we're going to become a society that's uncaring, that's poor, and inhumane. We see it with the drones, we see it in wars are taking place for no just cause. And notwithstanding the intellectual and economic and military might, if those moral values of Mandela and other people are lost in that particular discourse, we think lose up. And I think, therefore, the kind of citizens we want to produce in our country are quite extraordinary in the context of the global world. It's not about ICT, because ICT is critical. So if I share with you, and here's Dr. Maboya, she will tell you who's been saving you all the time, coding must not start in FET bed, you start in primary school. Because when the child goes to grade 12, 10, 11, and 12, ICT must be influential to your life. It must be part of their makeup. You don't even have to teach it. So this is part of robotics and coding in the primary school already in the CSA. You don't even teach it as a subject at a higher level. They've got it to teach in the future. So I don't disagree with you. I agree with you fully that we have to take care of our children. But we don't do so at the expense of history. So these are views that I share, and I'm not saying that I'm right. I may be wrong, and the dominant view may be totally different from mine. And if you ask me for my opinion, Dr. Maboya might come with something totally different from what I've said. So, the Ms. Majeke said that she wouldn't want it to be FET banned. I'll explain to you why I think it should be banned. And certainly, I feel that if you are mathematically inclined, it doesn't mean that you have become so illiterate. I mean, you've got to basically, language is an important skill that everybody is to have. And maybe I agree with you. What we've done, recognizing what you said, is we've introduced literacy even in our mathematics, in our workbooks. Look at our workbooks, you'll see literacy is introduced right from the beginning. Because if we don't do that, precisely what you are saying will happen. The children would be doing mathematical research, but don't have the literacy skill to be able to do numeracy. And therefore, we included in your numeracy the literacy element, and it's certainly something that's work in progress, but I recognize what you're saying, and I'm not disagreeing with you, because you are a teacher and you're also a professional. So we recognize the reality. But interestingly enough, and in fact, what you're saying to us is what the world outside is here, and the university. There is a view that mathematical literacy is lesser than mathematics. My view, I've done mathematics in school, my view is I've looked at the content of it. Mathematical literacy is more critical than mathematics. Even if I speak English so well. And it's a functional ability that we require, but what we want to convince the universities about is that there should be parity of esteem between mathematics and mathematical literacy. And if they have a different view, they must provide us, like you said, Mr. Kennedy, of their reason why they have a different view. Because it is their concern that we introduce mathematical literature, They cannot say it's not our money. We have to get to the academics themselves. They said, no, you could offer paramedics or mathematics because both of them are education system. We want numerous students. So that goes as far as that is concerned. I recollect the issue about serving the pen. In fact, Dr. Petulianti was with me in the office and Naledi Pando at the time there is a concern. And it was a move. We were not the authors of the book, it was a publisher, screened independently of the department. The department, as I said, they've got a screening committee. They don't even know who the publishers are, they make the decision. And from time to time, you would have content that is going to offend. But what did you do? You can sit back and say, well, okay, that's it. Said, no, but this is not correct. I'm unhappy about it, and it was correct. So you're going to have errors in terms of how history might be reflected. But there is a responsibility. History itself has to be vibrant. I mean, you've got to basically say, it's not like that. It's the responsibility of the ruling party, and even the president to give his interpretation of maritime. But you can't stop the people from speaking about maritime. It has been a human rights abuse. Nobody's going to dispute it. It's a reality that you basically have to confront. And you can't duck it. If we duck it, we're going to become better. So you've got to confront that reality and say, how do you deal with it, and what are the lessons that you learn from it? There are many lessons that we can learn from it. Many, many lessons. It's a tragedy, it's a tragedy. You know, I tell the people, the colleagues who taught me in education, that perhaps the greatest catalyst for us in the Department of Basic Education in workbooks has been the Limpopo Saga. For 8 years after that, we haven't had late deliveries, we have 100% deliveries on time to all schools. Because for the first time, the reality of a mishap like that, when you instruct somebody else to do the job, confronted us and said, how do we change our mechanisms in a different way so that we have the efficiency that we have? And I'm saying, history will speak up those very, very lessons that we could have. I certainly agree with your I know you were diverting and said so about the interview. I think Sundar Vishaka must be, it's not only about your application or your choice of subject, it is about your commitment and your passion for the profession. And interviews are critical and essential to be successful progress. Here, you know, you cannot promote Sundar Vishaka on the one hand and discriminate against a parent who sends his or her child to university at their own cost. And they are denied the same access and opportunity. They must be promised to be and that is the view that the ministry has in relation to teachers who have qualified. There has to be parity. But what we are saying, what we've been arguing about, is you cannot have an unqualified temporary teacher when you have a Sundar Vishaka. It just doesn't make sense. You cannot have a person who's not skilled in the subject teaching a classroom when you have a qualified, skilled teacher who is a Sundar Vishaka. And that has been the thing. We've never argued against or to say prefer the Sundar Vishaka graduate above that who's been privately funded. And that I'm very, very clear about in terms of policy and approach. But what we should learn from you or take from you is that maybe the implementation isn't as it should be. And we should correct that. We should correct it. So thank you for raising that. My name is Dosha. Yeah, you always will be. I think an auditing is very important. An auditing of teachers and their capacity and their ability and their competence is important. An auditing of the number of learners that are doing history in grade 10 and 12 is also important for us. Because when we make the choice in this teaching and when we implement it, it becomes critical for us to know exactly what is the capacity that we have and what we have to do simultaneously as we implement. I have no difficulty with that. I know the view seems to be, the dominant view seems to be from the DA, and I think you'd be entitled to that view, is that leave it at up to grade 9, it is compulsory. Think very carefully if you want to introduce it to grade 10, 11, and 12, but if indeed you want to do so, you might want to look at a bifurcated approach or a hybrid rather than, not a bifurcated, a hybrid rather than an additional factor. Let's say we listen to your view is more strong in terms of the first option is to leave it up to grade 10. I don't want to distort what you're saying. We I think, it seems to be that ANC has a different view in so far as that is concerned. And let's look at it carefully and make the appropriate decision. I would argue, though, very, very strongly for the offering of history as it's about to discuss it, because value and meaning should be evident to all of us who speak about it. And the struggle is all about changing that particular course of history that we did not, we did not create, but we inherited as a result of the unfortunate circumstances of the past. And now to be dismissive about that history or regarding it less important, given the fact that we achieve equality, would almost be an ungrateful gesture, because we're still in the focus of states, we're still in transition. We haven't arrived at the kind of social cohesion and integrated society that we have to. There might come a time in about 10, 20 years' time when we might say, look, let it get elected. I think we've grown enough, we've cohered enough. But drive around the city, drive around the town, the whites are sitting one place, the blacks are sitting one place. It's the truth. Go down to the commercial centers and you see, go to the center of town where the whites move out, the blacks come in. That's our reality. Now we can see our history is not unimportant, given that what we see every day. Go down to the shopping mall, see what's happening. Those are the real realities that we've got to confront. We don't even need history books to see that. But we need to our children to understand that history, to say the society that we want to live in, it's not the teaching of our African children only, it's for the Indian child, for the white child, for the current child, to understand it, that this achievement of our democracy is about nation building, it's about social cohesion, it's about respect and tolerance. And that can be best, in my opinion, taught through history. But of course, life orientation is still in terms of civil education. Now, I'm just going to now try to talk along because I'm something on history, I think, but yeah. The Koza, thank you very much for yours. I think it's also a relation to what Kay is saying before you. You know, review 3 to 5 years, that's the recommendation, it's not the part of this decision. But I think there won't be any disagreement or serious disagreement that we should separate, in fact, history from geography in the early years. I'm not talking about the as well. There won't be any disagreement that we have to review the content of the curriculum. And there's no reason why we can't do this in phases. So even while the discussion is taking place about FET, which may take 3 years, which may take 4 years, which might even take 6 years, it's not something that we're rushing to say can happen now. When we haven't done the proper audit, when we haven't looked at the scope of it, and everything else. But we could basically say, in terms of your content, let's work on it immediately. In terms of the separation of the subject, we might want to work on it immediately. And we might want to say, let's not waste time in terms of introducing it. You know, you can introduce a subject in grade 10, in the first year, grade 11, 10 and 11 in the second year, in grade 11 and 12, in the third year. So that in itself would take 3 years for introduction. So if we were to introduce it in 3 years, it would take another 3 years before the curriculum writes the examination. But you're giving a clear signal of intent to say history is going to be compulsory. So that is a view that I have. It's not a bad view. It's a view that I have, and I'm just sharing that particular view. There has to be a discussion with the union. And I think we must be able to persuade the union. They are the teachers. No school time. We can't pretend that it doesn't matter. It does matter. I'm agreeing with you. It's going to be a relationship. And unless we have all unions on board, we are then able to implement a new program. But that conversation is very, very difficult. So Chair, I thought I've answered your questions as well, and I'm sure Dr. Mavoya may want to add to it. But I really am saying to you that I'm enlightened by, I'm really educated by all the views that have come forth. And I'm not dismissing any of them. This is work in progress. Consultations are still taking place, and I think the debate has not ended, nor is the decision is taken. That I can assure you, the minister nor the CEM has taken the decision to say, we're taking option one, we're taking option two, we're taking option three. We say, let the consult approach is finalized. Then we take it to the Council of Education Ministers meeting and look at the matter and then make an informed decision. But at least we've had the benefit of having all the stakeholders views regarding this. Thank you.
Let me also appreciate
other families, just to try to respond to some of the questions. I think with regard to Honorable Matthias's concern around making things to compound, I do agree with you that first we need to strengthen our motivation. So we will definitely do that. But also to say that history, as one of the social sciences, has become more important, I think, in this era than before. In the era where we are living alongside nature, in the fourth industrial revolution, in fact, even for your skills for the future, history has become more important than just mobility. So when it comes to IT and coding, I think there's some work that is being done, which will be at some point also presented to the community. But also to say that the concern that was raised by Honorable Matthias around students who are doing math, science, and technology, I think history is also very important for them. In the sense that most people who have done great history might not even be aware, for instance, that Egypt is dubbed, Egypt, which is in Africa, by the way, is dubbed as the educational capital of the ancient world. Most of your philosophers, great Greek philosophers, they actually studied in Egypt. You've got Plato, you've got Socrates, you've got Aristotle. In fact, Aristotle, for instance, did his work and in Egypt, which is in Africa. So if we don't highlight that, even your science and math students might not be motivated. And learning, I mean, that's link with the past actually also helps us to solve problems, because we would want to know, for instance, how come when we thought there was no technology at all, that the Egyptians were able to build those pyramids. So that creativity is what we make in terms of the science and mathematics. We also talk about, we know those who tell men, that Pythagoras, the theorem of Pythagoras, was invented by Pythagoras, who also studied in Egypt, in Africa. So that history is very important even for learners that we think are more into science and technology, therefore they might not need it. They need it because they will then, we can through history invoke their creativity as well as their problem-solving skills. And Honorable Baston, I think you've taken your point regarding consultations with unions. What we'll do, we'll review the schedule so that at least we bring the date forward, so that we will address this as soon as possible. And the focus on foundational skills of reading and writing, this is quite central when we talk about skills for the 21st century. We are currently, as a system, focusing on the foundation, and reading and writing are the skills that we actually need. I think, Funza Lushaka, with regard to the question from Honorable Bosho, we know what we meant when we reflected on the slide on Funza Lushaka. What we meant is that the history teachers will be amongst the priority area, not that we are going to exclude others. We still have priority. And we are also, as I indicated, looking at the reskilling and upskilling of teachers on, so that we don't only depend on the new teachers that enter the system. With regard to the state of readiness, normally when we report on the state of readiness, we have a number of indicators, and one of them would be teacher capacity, whether we have the necessary capacity. And of course, this will also be part of what we do. As we prepare the system, we'll have to look at the teacher capacity. And also, I think what Honorable Kosa raised around mobilization, that is very important. It is something that we have to do. in order also to look at the issues of change management so that we can be able to attract more teachers that will be interested in history. And that will be part of what we'll be doing as we get the system ready for 2020. And Chair, I think I've covered you in terms of the readiness, because your concern was to say when and how are we going to address the whole issue of the contract. And we are saying that this is one of the indicators we'll be engaging with DHS about the content of their teacher program. But we can also indicate that the appointment of the ministerial task team, the reappointment, the approval, therefore we are just waiting for it from the minister. Once we've gotten that, then the task team will start with the work of actually looking into the content as we have presented. And the discussion with the unions, of course, is quite urgent and imperative. We'll look into that.
I think we need to have really tried to respond to all the questions that have been raised. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Thank you very much.
And we understand that it's still a work in progress.
Mm.
Thank you very much for the initial presentation on this. Once we're going to form the progress moving forward as to what political the conclusion. What is actually your final decision as to say how are we going to see this history, the renewal of the content of history throughout the system in our education? How are you going to do it, and with the various scenarios that you have just presented to us? So it's one thing that the rest of the floor committee will keep on following up, and now that I can continue to update us on what is happening. Yeah, the best on the work that has been done, we have heard, we are happy that something has been done, and the opportunity that the committee has even got to have input as you continue with this program of making sure and seeing better scenarios of how this thing is going to be implemented in our school. I know, dear, this can be a very political topic, and I was lucky to say for the first time in our committee where there will be this line among the political parties that say, it's good, but what I appreciate from the Honourable Members, the manner that you have taken the discussion, yes, we all have our political mandate, but for me, it was very much progressive, and we're all building, looking at what is best for our learners, what is it that should be offered to our learners. So really, that spirit of handling this highly political discussion that we had today, I think we managed to handle it very well as the members of the committee. DM, can I then hand over to you just to wrap up, and we're still getting to this other one, Honourable Members, the rural education policy. Again, it's a progress. At least with them, it's just to give us an update, because we know we have had a lot of discussion when it comes to it. We want to know now how far have they gone from the initial presentation that they have just given us. DM.
Thank you very much, Chair. Please don't speak after the Chair, so I'm not going to add anything to the earlier discussion, but also to endure. And thank you to the members for Twitter committee chair and the discussions to place. I think it was a remarkable political maturity on all sides. Perhaps maybe just to say on that one there, you know, it's amazing. We're talking about the fourth industrial revolution. And the algorithms in computers could not take place, or could not occur without zero. The zero itself was covered by either the Babylonians or the Sumerians, but really refined by the Indians. So if the Indians were not there, without zero, we would not have computation. And that's the reality. So what we celebrate today in terms of the enormous power of technology has certainly roots in the zero. And it comes first from the Sumerians and Babylonians and then the Indians. Of course, the Arabs would argue that they actually discovered it and must have been defined by the Indians, but it doesn't matter. I'm saying knowledge is universal, it doesn't matter which quarter it comes from, but we both, and then what we learn from each other. Chair, I'd like to ask this committee and yourself, to allow me just to make a few remarks and then to be excused. And the reason for it is I have a very important task, and the colleague from the IFP is not here, but he would have been very excited to know that we've just completed a series on reflections on the Constitution. And all the negotiators, all across political parties, including his political leader, is in those books. So you've got Tony Leon, you've got Patricia Dolow, you've got everybody. And those are reflections in that book, which is basically the assistant parliament we coordinated it on behalf of parliament. So it's going to be launched next year. I'm actually making the announcement before the speakers, next month, not next year, as part of our heritage. But it's a wonderful demonstration of how, as South Africans, we are able to put together in a book uncensored perspectives of all political parties 20 years after the fact. So we could say, we don't say the ruling party, governing party, we only take those voices, all voices out there. And I think that's the manner in which we should approach our history as well. But you've got to hear all voices. So if this is opinion, precisely, it's not a problem. Now, Chair, with regard to rural development, it's so critical and so necessary. It's again, part, it's something that starts off with a round table. We recognize the need for it. We had a round table, a task team was set up with very, very strong recommendations. And if you look at the composition of the task team, it's got about 6 universities represented over there. Clearly the academics, we have one non-academic, and all provinces and unions have passed. Rural education is very, very critical. I'm not going to take Dr. Kutumaboya's word for this. I'm going to say 3 things that I'm going to ask you. The first is, we cannot wish away the reality of motherhood, particularly in sparsely populated areas. We would like people not to exist in the future, but it's something that exists. About 25% of the schools are multi-grade. We should say as a transition, what do we do to enhance capacity of those educators and create an environment that conduces to learning where there is a multi-grade. And I think the Western Cape, for example, has set a model of how to deal with rural multi-school education in the rural school. And we've been sharing practices best practices over here. The second point is, as we speak about rural education, we must recognize the reality of migration from rural to urban areas, from south, within provinces, and from across provinces. So the Western Cape will tell you, for example, that they receive about 25,000 to 30,000 new learners every year. Gauteng will tell you they receive not less than 85,000 every year. Just in grade 1 and grade 8, by the way. And it's a huge step. So and you find that the numbers in your school, even when we provided infrastructure, had decreased. So shouldn't we look, when we look at rural education, shouldn't we look at it with an eye also on urban education? Because your rural child is migrating from the rural area with historical disadvantages and lack of opportunity in those environments coming to an urban area. How do you assist that rural child in an urban context? I just thought something not in the report, which you might want to do. And the third, and perhaps the last point that I want to make before I ask to leave, is that we've done extraordinary work, and that's why I must believe in our country and our future, in terms of digitization and technology. As you speak right now, Dr. Maboya will tell you, 85% of our high enrollment subjects have been digitized, where we own the intellectual property of textbooks from grade 1 to grade 12. There's more than 367 readers that we digitized in all languages. So if you take your workbooks, you take your readers, and you take the 121 titles, we've got more than 800 titles that we own intellectually. And we've done so with collaboration with the private sector, and it's cost out nothing. We are 85%, we've got to reach 100%. And that is where the difference should take place and must take place in the rural education system. You're right. It's called industrial revolution. And if we can basically get connectivity and digitized content to every child in every home, in every rural area, I think we've got a long way. It's again not in the presentation. And I raised it as almost a very personal private project to make sure that we're able to reach out to people. But I think I would ask Dr. Maboya to do the rest. Politely and humbly ask you to excuse me, because what I'm going to be doing is also for the future of our country, part of our heritage, if you would excuse me. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
There was also a ministerial committee that was formed in 2005. So we actually come a long way in trying to address issues of rural communities, in particular rural education. Now let's talk about this policy that we are presenting, the draft policy that we are talking about. So these are the research team members, co-research team members that we are talking about. These are people who are experts in rural education that were enlisted to provide support to the sector. And the methodology that was used, there were a number of research team meetings, reference team meetings, desktop research conducted, and there were provincial consultative meetings with consultative forums. There were also union bilaterals that were conducted, and then there was this writing retreat that took place where teams were amassed to write the draft document that we have as our draft policy. There was a two-day writing session, and consultative forum with SGB Association is one of the things that we did. Right. Now, what is the conceptual framework that actually sort of frames this particular policy? So this was framed around three important principles. So these three principles of concept that we are talking about, this is social connectedness, which was addressing the issue of the disconnect that is there with the situation of rural communities. So in which case, in terms of social connectedness, it's more about DBE and schools working and collaborating with rural communities to mobilize the resources available in the rural communities. Then the concept of self-esteem is at the way with me that because of the isolation, the social disconnectedness, we find out that this has got a lot also to do with the self-esteem of these communities, where they look at themselves as being the disadvantaged people, you know, feeling ashamed of themselves and not really valuing themselves. And the other one is about functional services, where we are saying the environment in which these communities live would have to have the necessary, you know, services, such that they also are valued as human beings. So it's the whole issue of bringing in humanity in what we are doing. The draft, in fact, the purpose of the policy, as I indicated, is to improve access to education as well as the quality of education for all in rural schools, and to provide a framework for a context-specific, relevant, and sustainable strategies to deal with the challenges in rural schools while drawing on existing strengths in rural communities. So I need also to mention that the thinking behind this whole policy is from the premise of a situation or an environment that has got assets more than from a deficiency model. So we're looking at the rural communities as a resource, as an asset, more than as a deficiency. Improving the quality of education in rural schools that will allow for the creation of appropriate strategies and practical interventions. So again, the rationale for the policy comes from the imperative as prescribed by the Sustainable Development Goals, especially goal number 4, the framework for action, the UNESCO framework for action, as I indicated, the Constitution of the Republic, National Development Plan, and all these are given as the mandate to do what we are supposed to do in terms of making sure that we provide quality education to the rural schools.
Now, this policy has got three pillars. And the first pillar, you go to the previous slide. The first pillar is that of developing developing quality rural education. I think we have been talking about quality education throughout the presentation so far, in terms of the rationale, in terms of the mandate and so on. Quality education is a major concern. So that is why it becomes one of the pillars. Now within this, we are saying there's a need for us to classify schools. And this is prompted by the fact that we currently don't have a similar definition for rural and diversity within this context. And that poses a question, I mean a challenge to us. So as a result, we're looking at the rural as referring to tribal land, sparsely populated areas, dense settlements, as well as mining towns in rural context, where mining, including where mining is no longer, you know, active. And then how do we classify rural schools? Diversity calls for a classification of rural schools which should be informed by a set of indicators or filters. We are talking diversity here because much as we are talking about quality education, but we need also to be mindful of certain filters that distinguish rural schools from your mainstream schools. And this will be informed by the location, the school space, the school size, and all those various things. Now we are also talking about the review and alignment of the curriculum. In actual fact, we are talking about the offerings, the subject offerings that we provide to these schools in rural areas. To say that we need to have those offerings that promote a sense of place, pride, and belonging in the school community. We need also to look at, we need to provide those offerings that recognize the scarcity of resources, but at the same time that acknowledges and handles the resources and knowledge that exists in rural communities. For instance, in rural communities, we need to look at the issues of sustainable development, issues of the environment, because you must also remember that these are areas where you would have some rivers going through those areas, mountains and so on. This is where we are saying we really need to look at issues of nature conservation as one of the areas that we need to be very strong on when we talk about rural education. Also talking about, for instance, as one of the economic drivers, agriculture as one of them, right? Where we're looking at you know, offerings that would address issues of scarcity of water, issues of the land itself, and so on. A curriculum that reflects the aspirations of individual learners and communities while responding to the well-being and development needs of the community. In terms of language, we are saying because of the multilingual nature of this setting, we also need to take that into consideration. The development of LCSM in home languages that are reflective of the very rural setting in which the schools are, the strengthening of SGP capacity, and the learning of indigenous languages. And agriculture, I don't think we can really avoid talking about agriculture. The education system can contribute to further economic, social, and human development in rural areas by expanding agricultural education. And here by expansion, we mean that it should also be expanded even to your rural areas as education as an offering in our curriculum. But also to say that we need to invest in appropriate LPSN teacher training as well as partnership with key role players. Now, in as far as agriculture is concerned, we are looking at the offering that will be able to empower these learners to participate in the whole value chain in as far as agriculture is concerned, because agriculture obviously will not only be around farming, it also involves a lot of other activities, your logistics, transport, and all those things. It will also involve issues of marketing and so on. So we are saying that we need also to take that into cognizance. The whole thing is to say we need to provide or to offer subjects that really speak to the reality of your learners in this business. As an art, culture, and sport, we are saying that much as art, culture, and sport is important for your learners in every urban area, it is equally important for learners in this area. Now, the next pillar is around the resourcing of these rural schools. We're talking here about recruiting young people as volunteers in curriculum support, administrative support, as well as for and to attract them to the teaching profession. We are talking about what could be done within those rural communities. We already have a project that is currently running where we have recruited young people from the very same rural communities to attract them to become teachers, because we see the importance of really having people who for the interest of the rural community at heart to be the ones that drive education. Mobilizing the school community in development of initiatives, mobilizing elders to share cultural heritage, I think it links up again with the history recommendation, but also to establish a partnership to be able to increase the capacity of the state. Recruitment and retention and development of teachers, this policy seeks to create a package of teacher incentives that go beyond finance, but include teacher development, career progression, transport, recreation, and other essential services. Not just about the money, about finance, about salaries, but beyond that. It seeks also to look at the services of teacher villages that include teacher development centers, education villages, higher education institutions to offer programs relevant to rural education, and also to try to provide various types of support for specialized educators in your sciences, your math, agriculture, technology, language, and English. We do have small schools in rural areas, and in terms of primary schools, this should have, we are saying in this policy that such schools should have what you call a special post provisioning norm. Instead of using your normal post provisioning norm, there should be special one for this small primary school. And in terms of secondary schools, the policy is making provision for the introduction of itinerant teachers who may be used to serve more than one school where qualified teachers are not available. As we are all aware that it is very difficult to get highly qualified teachers in certain subjects to go and work in this rural area. Other requirements for small schools include issues around establishing a center to service and cluster of schools, and in this case we are saying, of course, the issue of the radius will also be taken, have to be taken into consideration as we do this, because we know that in some other areas these schools are very far apart from each other. And the provisioning of LTSM, looking at leveraging on ICTs to ensure that we also provide LTSM to the learners in this rural area.
The small school, other requirements for small schools as per the draft policy include support staff including a senior admin clerk, a senior and a security guard. But we are mindful of the fact that we don't have limited, unlimited resources. Therefore, we are looking at establishing a center for a cluster of schools with those services that you mentioned above, whereby a cluster of schools can be properly serviced, having such a center, and also taking into consideration, you know, the radius and the proximity of the school to the center. Right? Inclusive education. I don't know, this might not necessarily be in your presentation, but inclusive education, we cannot leave out inclusive education because we know that in those rural settings, we still have learners who need specialized assistance. And what we are saying in this policy is that in order to strengthen the implementation of the curriculum in special schools, we need to strengthen implementation of curriculum in the special school to strengthen the implementation of inclusive education policies in rural contexts, and also to ensure that rural learners have access to special needs education and to establish special schools in rural contexts, because currently the scarcity of such schools in your rural context. And the third pillar that the policy or the draft policy speaks to is around roles and responsibilities. And we're looking at the roles and responsibilities at different levels in the system. National level, what is the role of a national department? So to establish that rural education advisory committee, to establish interdepartmental collaboration, to establish national team of key heads of branches in terms of planning, in terms of monitoring, and the whole issue of promoting accountability as well. Right? At provincial level, there's a need to have a directorate, or at least a sub-directorate for rural education. We're struggling a bit with the provinces because, I mean, rural education is taken as a by-the-way function, whereas we are saying in this policy that if there is a need to establish at least a directory or at least a sub-directory, depending on the number of rural schools for rural education. Establishment of a provincial rural education committee, almost the same type of structure that we are establishing at level, at national level, we need to see that happening at provincial level. Right? The next one. At district level, there should also be such a structure that exists to coordinate the activities around rural education. At school level, the SGB's responsibility includes mobilization of the community. We have already indicated the importance of taking the community on board with regard to the provisioning of education in rural areas, because we have recognized, or we are recognizing the resourcefulness of this community. Identifying and harnessing resources, cultural, natural, and material and social resources to support teaching and learning. And in conclusion, we are saying the policy aims to ensure that rural schools provide quality education for all learners in line with the democratic principles of the Constitution, as well as in line with the vision of the NDP. This requires overcoming many challenges of concern to the macro environment as well as school level disparities across the public school system. And we would want to recommend you that the committee should discuss this draft policy and provide the necessary input and guidance on the policy itself. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much for the presentation.
I was still spending at 25% of the money to go to. That is why I'm asking to 25, been speaking of the issues of managing, managing, and so forth. I'm still there now. Where are we now? But I think it goes back to the issues of data in the system.
Okay.
Are we updating our data or not? Because really, I think I'm challenging by 25% now. It has been years where it's been set for 25%. I don't think it's great. Oh, and I mean, my last set was a presentation, can we have a little bit? Another question? Another Manchester? Another workshop? Another question?
Thank you very much. I also want to welcome this proposal for rural education. Yes, certainly you know that we have got several challenges with regard to rural education, which is mostly characterized by the provision of infrastructure such as building and furniture and many others. So we want to believe that on implementation, all these issues that are negatively affecting the education of the learners in rural areas or rural schools, they going to be covered by this type of initiative of rural education. Chair President, I also want to request, as the presenter has indicated, has spoken about the issue of inclusive and special specialty education, because really in rural areas, more especially where one is coming from, it is very serious because we seem to be overlooked, and they are given to a department that is really not offering education to the children with disabilities and the like. Because what is happening is that they are just offered a care like it doesn't necessarily given food and such things, but really with regard the education is zero for now. We've got very few special schools in rural areas to understand that we also have the majority of those who are supposed to be at school, they happen to be in a waiting list, checkers, and you have seen when we're on oversight, those that are on a waiting list are in a majority. There are more than those that are really in an actual plan. But we with this initiative want to believe that really it is going to assist. The other issue that has been raised is with regard to higher education institutions offering a relevant subject. Yes, we would also like the department to further engage with different stakeholders, as it has been presented, the chairperson, that they are in consultation with many stakeholders, but further engagement in those communities need to be seen to be taking place and be seen by everybody, so that this proposal or this policy will in fact receive much support to those communities that are expected to be benefiting from it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair, and also thank you for the presentation. I'm just because I think for me it was the first time that I was going through the draft itself because it was printed out. And I'm just a bit concerned that, you know, it looks like we're going to have, I might be wrong, two curriculums. One that is specifically going to be for rural learners and urban learners. That is something of concern because like, it looks like now they're discriminating between the rural learners and the urban learners. So I think we just have to be wary of that because we don't want to have specifically education for, you know, poor learners and, you know, in the rural areas. So that's a bit of a concern. And also there's a mention of agriculture as a subject within that now having a specific curriculum, having a subject like agriculture. But there's also another recommendation within the policy that talks about agricultural schools. I think, you know, when it comes to agriculture, we have to look at, you know, agricultural schools, and those should be in each and every province, so that those learners who have interest in agriculture should be able to access and go to agricultural school. Because it doesn't mean that when you live in a rural area, you want to study agriculture. It doesn't basically mean that. So I think what we need in the rural areas, I think we've said this many times, we need to have proper infrastructure. We need to make sure that we get rid of teacherless. We need to make sure that we have teachers that are qualified in rural areas. The question is, how do we get them there? Because based on the fact that there is, let's say for instance, the Fundali Shaka graduates that actually applied to go teach for 4 years in a rural area, they haven't been able to actually abide to the contract. So how do we compel them to ensure that they do go to rural areas? And also to ensure that, you know, they are able to go there and stay, because the problem is that the fact that, you know, the area is very much isolated, and some of them, they come from, you know, metros, and then urban valley, they are forced now to go to a rural area. It is a struggle. I mean, it's a big challenge, because the standard of living between the urban area and the rural area is so vast that, you know, you end up having water in your house, from your tap in your house, and then able to go to your river to go and get water. I'm just making that kind of difference between the two lives that you have to adjust and adapt to. So the idea of providing accommodation and also incentive and also having the type of, you know, like recreation that comes in with that. So we really have to look at that. But most importantly, what I would like to recommend is that let's be specific in terms of going to the particular villages. Like, for instance, if you have a school in one village, you can go and scout the learners, the girl child learners, to try to get them to go and study education so that they can come back and work in the village. Because, you know, they know the village, they have family, so it's actually easier to get them to get back. So really something that we can actually look at to say, like, let's be more and like entice more the learners from the area that they go and study and then come back and be able to teach. That is much easier than having somebody from the urban area, mm-hmm. which has been an actual challenge. That's my input. Thank you, Chair.
Before I come to Honorable Shaw, what Honorable Martins has just mentioned, the issue of two curriculum, I think even for me, the whole presentation, we are saying we are going to be creating a specific curriculum course. It's a concern. Unless you convince us otherwise, the manner, the way we have presented it, it says we are going to be having a different curriculum for the rural areas, of which let us register it up front. There's a committee. I don't think that's something that we can avoid. But maybe we are going to expand on that. Mm-hmm. Try to cover up what we are going to do better, the conditions in the rural areas. But when it comes to curriculum itself, it's very difficult. We can't create a curriculum for the rural areas. What are we saying in the country? You know. But it's fine, because I was thinking that Honorable Bosho.
Thank you, Chair, for raising that as well.
I'm also very concerned because it boils down to stigmatization, and that's something that we should steer away from. Also with regard to special needs, we don't just have special needs learners in rural areas. There are many in the urban areas. But what I'd like to know is that, in general, this presentation doesn't have specific implementation information yet. But it's more of the structure in which it will unfold. What I'd like to know then is, with the additional of directorates and district committees, would this not require additional resources in an already resource-limited context? And then if you go to the draft policy on page 16, section 7, could you explain to me what the urban agenda is? It just doesn't make sense to me. And then, any change to the curriculum policy must not disadvantage rural learners relative to urban learners when it comes to qualifications for further education and training. Because as Chair and Honourable Machesi said, we are clearly, the presentation speaks to clear differentiation between rural and urban education. Just recently, you now speak of special schools, let's go back to it. The Minister admitted that we have to build 34 new special needs schools. Could we, for 25 years down the line, with 500,000 special needs learners not in schools, and now we decide to build special needs schools? Could you tell us where the resources are going to come from, where the teachers are going to come from, etc., etc.? We were in the Northwest Province last week. We spoke about the focus school for agriculture. It is clearly not working because they don't have the necessary resources. They don't have the qualified teachers. They are struggling. So you need to put in more effort and come back with a comprehensive report on how you see it all work. I'm very two-minded about the volunteers. It's good to get volunteers on board, but we must remember every single person in the education field must be vetted. How are you going to go about vetting these volunteers if they do not qualify for a state certificate? The establishment of partnerships whereby people are going to support teaching, could you expatiate on that for us as well? That's it. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Another question.
Chairperson, thank you. Mostly I'm covered by my colleagues, especially on inclusive education. I have nothing to say now. They have said them out. For me, is to appreciate the presentation, the testimony, and to say, because I think it's high time that we speak and do and fast track this initiative. It is a good initiative. Rural community is a community that that really feels neglected, not being part of your South Africa. Because wherever you go, you can feel the inequalities and injustice of the past. I like the tool, although it's still a framework, it's still a key initiative thing, because it also classifies what do we mean by saying rural community. You know, we come up with all these ideas, they fail because we don't have a tool to speak to. There was a time when we spoke about rural allowances or incentives. It was so difficult to implement it in so much that it ended up being implemented differently because there's no tool that guides us. So I take this as a good initiative. How do you work with other departments when you are taking such initiatives? Because this will need lots of, will need the other department to buy the idea. You know, Chairperson, over this research period, I gave a young man a hike from Tamil to Kalahari, and he had just a small pastor, and through the discussion, I noticed that to come to town, he paid them about 200 rand, going to buy a pair of shoes for a child from their store, 189 rand. That cost 189. That means for this shoe, he paid 49. So when presentation was being done here, I thought about how do we talk to each other as departments when trying to bring some change in areas. We have this department that is the Rural Development, Department of Rural Development. Do you consult them also to make it as it has been said by the former speaker that, you know, teachers don't want to go to the rural area because resources are so scarce. You don't even get a smaller Nyana shop to buy a loaf of bread. Being an educator there, when going to school on Monday, you must be sure that you have 2 to 3 loaves of bread because there are no shops around. There are no one. How do we link our initiatives like taking resources to the people with other departments and so on? So for me, this whole thing is a good initiative, but I think we must try to involve other departments as well so that we must not be the only resources that not be the only department that is giving resources that will make the environment conducive for educators and students. And another question is, you know, you will get a grant for this, but grant for that one. How many grants do we have in department? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Come, do we have also a rural grant? Whereby we open it, do we make that donors and funders should buy to our ideas? Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you. Dr. Mabuya, I think basically the understanding that we all have, when it comes to rural education, there is nothing much of a problem when it comes to curriculum level. Because I'm just thinking on the presentation when you say we must emphasize more on agriculture when it comes to that is an impact that is needed in other schools. I think basically the discussion that we are having and our concern when it comes to the issues of rural education are the positions. Once we deal with that, once we are able to attract teachers to go there, because
as we are saying, even on recruiting learners from the rural areas, Fundar Lushaka is doing that. But we once discussed that, I think we were in this room. You take me from Durban, you go take me to UKZN, I get qualified. There's nothing that interests me more much to go back and go anywhere again. You know, how are we doing the conditions conducive for the educators to stay there? How are we upgrading the issues of infrastructure? How are we talking to the issues of leisure transport, therefore more access to, you know, it's about access more than curriculum itself. So really, I think what we are emphasizing as a committee, we hear the presentation is there, but let us start where we need to start. Let us target the real areas where we need to target for us to improve the issues of rural education. I think again we are emphasizing on the issue of curriculum, saying we need to emphasize on curriculum change, that one we need to do. We can't discriminate like that. I can't go to a rural school and say, now I'm in a rural school, I have to learn how to do agriculture, swim, climb the mountain. It's good. Learning in that one should also be inclusive even in the urban area. If we want to enhance the topics that are done in school, let us enhance it throughout the curriculum, across the curriculum. But it cannot be specific for rural areas. With rural education, please, we are pleading, let us make sure what is it that you are doing to make the conditions conducive for quality teaching and learning to take place. Because that's the thing, we go out for our oversight to visit the rural areas. Some other time you cannot believe when we get back into those cars. Sometimes it's so quiet because we don't even know where to start when we are complaining to them, you know. So I think that is the plea is there to say, rural, is it a directorate? Rural education directorate, how best can we improve on the conditions, on resourcing our schools, on making sure there are things that attract teachers there. When it comes to the issues of curriculum and enhancing the curriculum, yes, we fully agree with that, but yeah, there are these things where we need to reach first before we can even talk of any other things.
Thank you, Chair. I believe that the major issue is around the curriculum, even the issue of functional services. Now, when you look at the model itself, that we projected, this model, it has that element of functional services. So, which means that we now need to really amplify what we are going to do in terms of this particular aspect of the model, and also collaborating with other departments. Because when you talk about functional services, there's no way we can be the only role player here. We need to involve other departments. So I agree with you, the committee, that we really have to be very strong in terms of making the conditions in those rural settings to be bearable for teachers to be able to want to be there. I think that point has been taken, to say how can we do that. That's why here we were emphasizing the fact that the policy focuses on the conditions beyond just incentives, but looking at other conditions that needs to be improved for these teachers. Because once you have improved this, I agree with you, Chair, that it would be easy to attract the skills to go and we can deploy skills in those in the rural settings if the conditions are conducive. So can I just maybe go through the questions so that we can be able to respond to the questions that they have. Honorable Kobra, I think, was spot on the issue of the unavailability of special schools to can accommodate learners, whether in the urban areas or in the rural areas. There is that problem, the systemic problem, where we don't have the sufficient, and I think that is something that really needs to be put into, because we acknowledge that
much as we can be able to stay in those rural settings, we need also to provide differentiated teaching to them. There are learners who really need to be taken to special schools. So we will also try to factor that into the policy as a need that needs to be. As I indicated, we already have a model that we have put to test now with the outreach teams that we have formed for going to our center for learners with severe intellectual disabilities. So there is a model that we are testing, and I think this is a model that we can learn from in terms of providing support to this rural school. And I do agree that we need to further mobilize these communities that tend to benefit out of this policy. So that is an ongoing, I think, work that we still continue to do to engage these communities. Honorable Matthiasi, even if it sounds like we want to offer a different curriculum, that is not the intention of the policy. The policy is just saying that whatever we offer to learners, whether learners are in an urban setting or in a rural setting, the learners must be able to relate to what we are teaching them. We are talking about a curriculum that is, you know, context which is context sensitive. We are talking about the curriculum for all the learners. In fact, the discussion that we have is that, you know, in our country we think that we need to broaden in the definition of inclusive education. Because when we talk about inclusive, normally we tend to think of inclusive in terms of disability, whereas inclusive is about inclusive, bringing everyone involved, especially the marginalized groups. And your disability groups would be among the marginalized. Your rural community would be among the marginalized. So inclusive in that fashion to say, our curriculum needs to be inclusive enough such that any learner, whether in rural or urban, should be able to relate to what they are doing. And that is not the intention to have two curricula, but Chair, as you have advised, we will go back and strengthen that area so that it doesn't appear like we want to change to offer two curricula. Mm. So that is not the intention, and that is not what this policy wants to do. It was just highlighting the issue of, you know, being able to relate to that, which applies, of course, even to learners who are in MNC. I agree with you. So we'll strengthen that area to make sure that we talk more about inclusivity, more than, you know, trying to stigmatize. And honorable question, stigmatization, I think we will have to ensure that when we finalize this policy, it doesn't seem to suggest that we are going to have two curriculums. I know there's a discussion that has been going on. And Dr. Langa is here as a specialist, she will also add, but we do acknowledge, I mean, that we need to do something around that. And the issue of the measure, what we forgot to mention when we did this presentation is that this policy comes in not in isolation, but it comes in once in the system we still have other programs that are running. For instance, this project, the project of measure, rationalization of schools, the project of ACD, for instance, where we are dealing with the math schools and your schools that are in unacceptable forms and so on. So it comes in when we are already dealing with some of the issues. But as to where we are in terms of measure, I don't know if Dr. Nanga will be able
you can do that. The issue of the volunteer, it is of course policy, but we need to vet the volunteers, which is what we did with the volunteers that are currently in the RIP program. You know that we got this RIP program, those volunteers have been vetted, if I'm not mistaken. But it's something that we are also taking into consideration. And the rural incentives, collaboration with other departments, all this. I think, members, this is a draft policy. And like any other policy, we are getting the input to improve it until it becomes a final policy. But what we'll also be doing is to have guidelines that will guide the implementation of this. And the other nitty-gritties regarding the departments that we'll be working with, how we'll be dealing with certain issues, those will be part of the guidelines in the implementation of this policy.
Chair, I think I can allow Dr. Langa also to respond to some of the
I think I would like to start with the question around page 16, section 7, where we are saying that the rehabilitation policy gives right to the driver of the patient reform and not a follow-up to the agendas and priorities. Just to the thought about that. In the ministerial task team of 2005, the conclusion that was made was that when we develop policies, we use urban areas as a benchmark. And also in the report that was published by OECD, where we were reviewing national policies for education, one of the findings was that most of the policies are failing rural schools because they are developed with urban schools in mind. So this policy then is now saying, look, let's develop policies so that now rural schools become a benchmark. Because if a policy can work in a rural school, it will automatically work in an urban school. So we now want rural schools to be, urban schools to be followers of the rural agenda. And that is why we want these schools to be great. We also want urban learners to go to these rural schools. And the issue of teachers' incentives. This policy is based on consultation. In other words, we always say that it's the voices of rural communities. We consulted the parents, teachers, and learners as well in rural communities. And the teachers said, look, when it comes to incentives, they don't just want money, but what they want is the environment that is conducive for teaching, and also an environment that would make them stay in these rural communities. And that is where the issue of edubility came in, where we said we'll have edubilities where teachers will stay, and these villages will have services that we will, then we'll talk to young teachers and say, what services would you want in rural areas that will make you stay there and leave there and not leave? And this is what then the policy is attempting to have. And the issue of the curriculum as well, here is about, I think it's semantics, it's the words that I use, because I then called the chairperson and I said, look, there's a challenge with this word curriculum, because there's an assumption now that we want to have a different curriculum for rural schools. And the response was no. In the context of this policy, a curriculum is broadly, we're broadly defining it as the totality of the learner experience. We're talking about what the schools are attempting to teach and the objectives at the end of the schooling life of a learner. At the moment, when we consulted, the parents were saying, look, there is no connection between what is happening in a school and what is happening in rural communities. There's no connection, there's a distance there. So for now, we are teaching their children to leave the rural communities. We're not giving them an option. There is nothing that is being taught in a school that will make a learner want to stay in a rural community and contribute to rural development. But we're teaching them to go to urban areas and go and work there, and they never come back anyway. So they then made examples of like agriculture to say, look, rural people are living in agriculture. They already have knowledge, and agriculture is part of their livelihood. But there's nothing in a school that is actually assisting a learner to get more knowledge around agriculture, current knowledge around agriculture, and maybe grow up to be a farm owner or something that the learner has already grown up learning. So we're not saying that agriculture, all rural learners should study agriculture, but we're saying we should have in rural schools a curriculum that speaks to the environment, that speaks to what is already happening there. And if we do it right, Chair, if we do it right, schools, rural schools will be attractive, and even urban learners who want to learn agriculture and they want to be farmers and they want to be farm owners, they will come and to rural schools and learn there. And when it comes to art and culture, we said art and culture, music, dance and everything is part of the culture in rural areas. That's what these learners spend Saturdays and Sundays doing. And they just do it for free, and we have groups that we know of ladies with Black Mambas, and they come from different rural areas, they taught themselves music. But there's nothing that is happening in our schools that is actually speaking to that, so that we assist learners in that area. So that is why we're saying we need to focus schools also on art and culture, so that urban learners can also come. And in that way, rural schools will now be the drivers of the education agenda. And when it comes to partnership, I think the issue of partnership with the LG Villages issue, and it does say in the policy that we want to link that to the other villages that are already existing if possible, and we are partnering with the Department of Agriculture and Rural Development on how we can have agricultural villages that have educate villages within. And at this stage, I think we are discussing on what services we will need in the villages so that we link these two. And with the classification of schools, we already have a project around that, and we are partnering with SSA, assisting us with everything. And we've already come up with new services. The project is about to come to an end, and we're piloting it in one province before the end of the year.
Draft policy.
members, I'm not sure whether there is anything that you want to say, but we are close to one now where we need to rush and have our lunch before we rush to the house. Oh, other than that, thank you very much. As I said, today, 2 days ago, it's work in progress. Thank you very much that we'll be working together, we'll be progressing together. So we'll be making our contributions and just to follow up on one, how these two important topics are going to be handled as well.